ora, and welcome back to System Fix, a podcast from the health media. My name is Barbara Fountain, and I am editor of New Zealand Doctor Rata Aotearoa. Each episode of System Fix, we take a look at progress with the reforms proposed for the New Zealand health system. These arose from the report of the Health and Disability System Review Panel, aka the Simpson Report. However, they have been significantly revved up by Health Minister Andrew Little to become what I like to call the Big Little Revolution. On System Fix, I speak with regular panellists and invited guests about the changes, the highs, the lows, what's happened to date, and what we might expect. Thanks for joining me. Kia ora, and welcome to episode 15 of System Fix. It's the Big Read. Joining me today are regular panellists Gabrielle Baker and Tim Tenbensel. And we're shaking it up today. Instead of banter about health reform progress, we're going to deep dive into the health reform legislation, which has just passed its first reading in Parliament. You might have heard of the podcast My Dad Wrote a Porno. Well, maybe think of this as the minister tabled a reform bill, or maybe not. Anyway, I'd like to say that we're reading this bill so you don't have to, but if you're already listening to System Fix, the podcast for health reform junkies, then I expect you're probably going to take a look at the bill that is designed to make reform happen. But before we get started, just a short recap. The legislation was introduced by Health Minister Andrew Little on 20th of October and passed its first reading today. That's the 28th of October. The bill runs to 102 pages. If you decide to print it off, it has four parts and six schedules. It starts with an explanatory note, which is a bit like a study aid. It might be cheating to start there, so we won't.
Oh, damn.
So we're going to rock on in. We've got the legislation on a phone for Gabrielle, an iPad for myself, and Tim has it on the big screen. Okay, Gabrielle, would you like to get started with the title of the bill?
Kia ora, yes, sure. So the title of the bill, this act is the Pai Ora Healthy Futures, will be the Pai Ora Healthy Futures Act 2021 or whatever year. And to me, I thought that that was an interesting choice of title, really signalling, I guess, from the outset that this is a bill that's trying to get us towards a different type of health and disability system. Thinking about Pai Ora comes, in this case, from the framework from Professor Sir Mason Durie, which has healthy futures as the kind of the objective, and it's got three components: whānau ora, which we're relatively familiar with, wai ora, which is really about healthy environments, and Māori ora, which is about kind of healthy individuals, healthy, you might want to think about that as healthy services. So I thought that this was an interesting way to signal your intention from the outset.
It was introduced by Andrew Little, and it is a government bill. It's the other information we get on the first page, and we've got the title, part one, part two. We scroll on to page two, down through the index, sort of skip all through that. Back to part one. The Parliament of New Zealand enacts as follows title. The Act is the Pai Ora Healthy Futures Act 2002. This Act comes into force on the 1st of July 2022. They have said pretty clear right from the start that health reforms are going to be introduced on the 1st of July. So now the purpose of the Act. Would anyone like to have a comment on this? We've got three A, B and C. Probably reflects pretty much the purpose of the reforms: promote, protect and improve the health of all New Zealanders, B, achieve equity by reducing health disparities among New Zealand's population groups, in particular for Māori, and C, build towards Pai Ora healthy futures for all New Zealanders.
The observation I have here, I mean, I wasn't really surprised by any of this, but I thought, given that equity is the thing that everyone talks about, and I listened to Stephen McKernan in your last podcast, you know, he was really quick to point that out as one of the driving factors here, that they would then revert to the reducing disparity language, which to me is kind of a bit archaic at this point. And the thing about equity is it talks about things being unjust and unfair. And disparity talks to just to difference. So I feel it was an interesting back to the future moment, but otherwise this was pretty expected to me.
Mm. It is interesting though to see if any of that kind of language will change later on, because if we had a sneak preview of the preamble, the study notes at the beginning, equity does feature quite strongly in those notes. So next we come on to the interpretation. Now, this is a handy section I've discovered. It has all the definitions of everything we're going to come across. The first definition is something new, and that's the Code of Consumer Participation, which is something we're going to learn more about later. Anything else that jumps out? A lot of these terms are quite familiar.
It's not a big one, but the term health entity is new language. And it took me a while to realise, reading through the bill, that they were just talking about government health organisations. But that's spelt out here in the interpretation. So I didn't read that first, but that's what it is. So it covers Health New Zealand, Health Quality and Safety Commission, the Māori Health Authority, Pharmac, and the New Zealand Blood and Organ Service. So that's a very important term in this bill.
Another one that stood out for me was locality. So locality means a geographically defined area determined under Section 48. So we'll learn more about that later. But again, up until now, there'd been the idea of a locality. There had been the idea that it could be geographically determined, or it might be determined on the basis of need of a particular group or similarity of a particular group or across some ethnic boundaries. So that was kind of interesting to see there.
Yeah, I think there's lots to say about that section of the Act.
Good
to get to that one.
There was a few more terms that we're coming familiar with, the health charter, the health plan, and the health strategy. At one point, I did have a second thought about, oh, strategy plan. Oh, yes, of course, that's the strategy where we're heading, and the plan is the operating part. So we skim on down. Actually, I don't know if you noticed this one, Tim, public health agency. I was surprised when I read that, and it said, means the public health agency established under Section 3E of the Health Act 1956.
No, but there must be something in the Public Health Act that stipulates it.
And one other thing that I picked up on was under public health services, it says services means personal health services, it's A, B, public health services, C, disability support services, and D, services provided to a person who has requested assisted dying under the End of Life Choice Act. I just kind of thought that was interesting that assisted dying is counted as a separate service from maybe personal health services.
Well, I guess that there may be some quibbles about whether you can define that as a health service.
Yeah.
For me, when I look at things like this, I always think, well, what's not here? So the things that are not here that might come in later, the kaupapa Māori services, which get referred to, and the context of the role and function of the Māori Health Authority. And I don't know, I kind of would have liked to see equity defined. And I guess there's probably a reason behind it, but things like commissioning, which became such a big feature of the, especially around the Māori Health Authority and its functions, not getting included here, which is notable to me, probably.
Mm. This is still the guide to the Act. Okay, so now, we're, as I said before, four parts and six schedules. So now the Te Tiriti o Waitangi. We've got the treaties set down as a separate part of interpretation.
And I can have a punt at this one.
Yeah, sure.
Me too.
I mean, to me, it's important to think about this clause in the context of what the government's trying to do in general and its relationship with Māori and its relationship to Te Tiriti. So as far as I can tell, as an outside observer, the Crown kind of tries to grapple with how it manages its treaty obligations and spells them out so that they're not too broad. The courts, though, and they've done this recently, say it doesn't really matter what you put in legislation, we're going to interpret the treaty across all of your responsibilities. But here, how I see this is that the transition unit, the cabinet, whoever's been touching this has decided we want to try to limit what the treaty applies to. So to me, this is quite a narrowing of your treaty obligations by saying it's only in these specific ways that we are intending to meet our treaty obligations. So if you think about what the Waitangi Tribunal has been saying in contrast, they are kind of pushing for a broader way of looking at the treaty. To me, this is quite a narrow clause. I'd be interested to see how people respond to it in the Select Committee, because to me, this doesn't really look like the expression of commitment to rangatiratanga, to equity, to active protection, to options, and to partnership that you might expect across everything. It's narrowed it to some specific things that it applies to.
Mm. Beginning of the clause on the treaty does say requires health entities to be guided by the health system principles. And then we go down to the next clause, which outlines the health system principles, which I must say, every time I see these little lists of principles around equity, access, and sustainability, I kind of keep looking and thinking, is that the same wording as I read last time? It seems like they're trying to say the same thing, but I'm never quite sure if the fact that the language is just slightly different, how significant that is each time they refer back to those particular principles.
I think it's quite hard to sort out which, you know, sort of there's objectives, there's principles, there's purpose.
Yeah.
So which bits are doing what and what are the principles for? And the other question I had about this one was, where does it fit with, say, things in the other documents and statutory required sort of things that are going to come out, things that are already there, such as the existing New Zealand Health Strategy? Again, it seems like another wash on a similar, not necessarily exactly the same task, but I guess it means you could go and look at different places and get different answers to what this bill is meant to do.
Mm. And for me, this one is supposed to relate just to the health system. And there's one of the things they define in the interpretation section is what the health system means. And it means those main entities you probably would think of, like the Health New Zealand, Ministry of Health, those health entities. And it also applies to a bunch of others, which flick through my phone, as we've already said. It's also the Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission, Health and Disability Commissioner, Artificial Limb Service and Health Research Council. So to me, this set of principles are the ones that apply to the institutions within the health system.
Except we later discover that some of these principles don't apply to some of all of them.
Oh, there's one important issue.
Well, there's a bit of a clunker. Well, I mean, maybe not clunker, but there's one that sticks out a bit, don't you reckon?
I think it's actually right at the bottom, number four, the health system principles in subsection 1B and C do not apply to PharmAc and the performance of its functions. Is that the clunker we noticed?
The clunker. That's what I noticed.
Yeah, because B and C are, you know, the health system should engage with Māori, other population groups and other people to develop and deliver systems and programs that reflect their needs and aspirations. For example, by engaging with Māori to develop, deliver and monitor services and programs designed to raise hua Māori outcomes. And again, C, the health system should provide opportunities for Māori to exercise decision-making authority on matters of importance to Māori, and for that purpose, have regard to both the strength of nature of Māori interests in a matter and the interests of other health consumers and the Crown in the matter. So both those principles do not apply to PharmAc.
My read of it, for what it's worth, and it may not be worth much, is this fits under sort of the PharmAc's general approach about public participation and transparency and, you know, its perceived need not to have anything of that nature specified. And, you know, in order to prevent, you know, say pharmaceutical companies driving a truck through their processes. That's what I interpret the motivation for that. It doesn't look good, though.
Mm. PharmAc does have quite a strong program working to improve health outcomes for Māori. Specifically, it's nice to have a surprise reading something like this, I suppose.
There's one other really interesting choice of wording in this one, which, Gabrielle, I don't know what you make of this one, but in 1D, it says the health system should provide choice of quality services to Māori. And I thought, I see what they're getting at, but I just thought that word, you know, wording was very interesting.
I actually hadn't picked that up till you said it, but it is a really an odd choice of words and something, just talking back to something you said before, Barbara, that the people who write this are really careful with the words they pick. They're not there by accident. So choice is there for a reason. And yeah, I hadn't thought about that before. Thanks for pointing that one out, Tim.
Yeah. Actually, that clause 7, section D.
1D.
The health system should provide choice of quality services to Māori and other population groups, including by 1, resourcing kaupapa Māori and whānau-centred services, and 2, providing services that are culturally safe and culturally responsive to people's needs, and 3, harnessing clinical leadership, innovation and technology to continuously improve services, and 4, providing services that are tailored to a person's circumstances and preferences, and 5, providing services that reflect Maturanga Māori. Interesting to see the term culturally safe in there as well. The health sector been grappling with over the last couple of years.
The wording of this aside, so the word choice I do think is really notable. It's really similar, but with different wording, to the way that the Waitangi Tribunal describes the principle of options. So that's about, you know, Māori having the choice to access services in multiple ways. So you can access kaupapa Māori or mainstream. But if you access mainstream, they need to be culturally safe and culturally relevant and work in partnership with you and those kind of things. So the wording there, to me, is linked to that principle of options, but it's just some interesting choices.
Okay, so now we get to part 2, key roles and documents. So subpart is all the responsibilities of the health minister. Now we know why there's 4 of them. So there's 4 key strategies, the health strategy, the Hauora Māori strategy, the Pacific health strategy, and the disability health strategy, and the government policy statement on health, which comes over the top of all of those. Forgot to mention that because that was something new for me, because when I first looked at it, I saw GPS further down and I didn't actually know what it stood for. Which then overrides these strategies. And then you have the health plan, which is developed by Health NZ and the Māori Health Authority.
And when I look at this, the comment about the disability health strategy I would make is that they're really spelling out and labouring the idea of disability health strategy. They're making it clear, I think, here that the health sector has a responsibility to the health needs of people with lived experience of disability. How I would interpret this is trying to move it past the narrow focus the Ministry of Health has had, in particular, at thinking about disability as the disability support services it provides. And so I was hopeful when I saw that it was disability health strategy, that it was a really positive signal. It did raise my eyebrow, given that there's lots of work still to be made clear to us about what's happening around disability.
That makes sense. And I think that is a very important modification.
When I was talking to Steve McKernan and Martin Hefford in the last podcast, probably got my head more around the health plan than I had previously. But I realised afterwards we hadn't really talked much about the health charter. And now I see the Code of Consumer Participation, which I know the Health Quality and Safety Commission was going to be involved with, looking at how consumers would be more involved in the sector. So presumably that's something they'll be working on. But the health charter itself, which is that kind of guidance for people working within the sector, expectations, I haven't really heard much more about that. I don't know if you guys have.
No.
So that's the minister's role, roughly. Then subpart two, Health NZ. So Health NZ is really the big change in all of this, of course, because we're doing away with DHBs to replace them with the central agency called Health NZ. Talk about it being established, a Crown agent within the Crown Entities Act, board of not fewer than five and not more than eight members. The minister must be satisfied that the board collectively has knowledge of and experience and expertise in relation to Te Tiriti o Waitangi, public funding and provision of services, public sector governance and government processes and financial management. That's interesting, that point about the chair of the Māori Health Authority. I know that Sharon Shea is on the board of Health NZ as well, but it's actually part of the legislation that happens.
When I saw this section, I was thinking the first time I heard it talked about was in your interview with Stephen McKernan, because I did hear him talk there about the health of people with lived experience of disability. It was in really close proximity what he was saying to the discussion about the appointments of members of the interim board. And I guess I'm acknowledging that my concern when I looked at the interim board members was that no one was identifying themselves as having lived experience of disability. This is a group that the health system is really poor at serving, and you'd think if equity was your driver, you'd be looking to include ways beyond advisory groups for people with lived experience of disability to have a say. And I thought maybe there'd be some inclusion of that in terms of skill, but there isn't either.
One thing I think is really interesting about the board of Health New Zealand is that apart from specifying the chairperson of the Māori Health Authority, there's no other sort of particular specifications of the mix of skills, for example, or composition in any way. So it's meant to give maximum scope, I guess, to a government in the space of who it wants.
The functions, we know that Health New Zealand is there to basically run delivery of services. A little bit more than that, Barbara. You're undercooking them a bit. I'm very sorry about that.
Back in section 13, the objectives, there's just one thing I'd like to pick up on there, which is I just want to preface this by saying the language of this bill compared to the old one, you know, you look at it and the sentences are shorter. Yeah, they're all one line. You know, it's actually much more plain English. It really does, you know, show some developments in legislative drafting over the last 20 years. And I think, you know, it's all the better for that. Of course, that has another sort of consequence perhaps about how things can be interpreted in various different ways. But the thing that I quite like this, in the objectives it says design, arrange and deliver, which I think is very plain language, and getting away from contracting, you may have expected the word commissioning if it was going to appear there. That's another thought about this. But I think it's just being very basic. And I actually think that's a good thing.
Well, that's a really interesting observation, because we'll come back to the other legislation later. So guys, just jump in whenever you feel like. If I'm scrolling past things that you think are significant, being a journalist, I've gone into the habit of speed reading and looking for particular words. So good to just point out, reiterate again, that the development of the Health NZ plan is a joint effort between Health NZ and the Māori Health Authority.
And something I will probably come to later, because there's specific clauses on it, but the Iwi Māori Partnership Boards, they kind of get introduced here. One of the functions of Health New Zealand being to engage with the Iwi Māori Partnership Boards. And there is more about that later, but I'm noting it now.
One thing, I think, subsection F, develop and implement locality plans. So it's saying that is specifically Health New Zealand's job, just in case that wasn't clear to anyone. It is.
And I've noted first use that word GPS, which we now know is the government policy statement. Now, is it subclause 3? In performing any of its functions in relation to the supply of pharmaceuticals, Health NZ must not act inconsistently with the pharmaceutical schedule, which is interesting because, am I getting this right? Maybe I'm not, but I do know that in the past, DHBs have been able to go and buy their own supplies of particular drugs. It was a big issue with one of the cancer drugs. So that's specifically saying that, no, you can't do that. That's interesting. That next clause, 15, Gabrielle, Health NZ must provide information to iwi Māori partnership boards, sufficient and timely information to support them to achieve their purpose.
I guess substantively that comes up later, but I guess this is acknowledging that, and actually it's something we've probably seen, any of us who have worked with current iwi partnership boards, that not every DHB is good at giving them the information they want to be able to monitor or be partners in how well the health system is doing for iwi.
One thing about iwi Māori partnership boards, yes, you look down in the details, there's, what, 18 of them, is it, Gabrielle?
Well, I think they're arguing that there's 20, but there was some anomaly with the list to me. So that might be that what's what it is.
Okay. So they were set up along DHB boundaries.
Yeah, I think I'll talk about it now. When looking at the iwi Māori Partnership Board schedule, the default seems to be that the existing DHB partnership boards will continue, and that they then set out a process for how you would establish a new one in time. That process is about all iwi in a defined district agreeing that this is the district and that they have processes to include Matawaka or Māori from outside the Rohe to be part of the iwi Māori Partnership Board as well. So there's like a process for that. But to me, when I look at the list of them in the schedule, they don't all seem to be current partnership boards. So I'm not sure where that information comes from. It looks a bit not suspicious. That would be going too far, but it doesn't quite make total sense to me.
It's interesting because actually we did a story the other day about the iwi Māori partnership boards, and I was actually thrilled to see that there was a list being produced, because actually getting that information together to have a starting list if you're going to have change so you can just see what does change. And yeah, so it was quite good that there was a list there. Another point in the additional collective duties of the Board of Health NZ was just regarding its financial situation, operates in a financially responsible manner, and for this purpose endeavours to cover all its annual costs, including the cost of capital, from its net annual income. Presumably that's just not the board members, that's actually the whole of Health NZ.
Yes.
Okay, so now we come down to subpart 3, which is the Māori Health Authority. There is a lot of discussion in the paper that accompanied, was it the regulatory impact statement, which we're not going into great detail here, but which actually was a really interesting read, about the decisions that went into choosing the entity that was going to be the Māori Health Authority.
Because I'm a nerd of this particular variety, I really enjoyed reading the regulatory impact statement on the Māori Health Authority. I just want to have a reflection on this. Is one of my concerns is that this bill has come out at a time when the health sector, and the Māori health sector in particular, is really, really stretched. Mm. And today they put up the date for putting in a submission to the Select Committee as the 9th of December, which is really not that far away. And when you think about the Māori providers in Auckland and Waikato, although not just providers, iwi groups, I'm concerned that all of this detail is available at a time when they are least able to prioritise looking at the detail because they're so busy responding to an emergency. So I've got a concern about that. So therefore, I feel it's on me to explain what the RIS says a little bit. It's an interesting thing because what they've done is done an assessment of the organisational form, and that's not really the kind of thing you would do in a regulatory impact statement. So it's an unusual one. What they've done is say that there are three options they looked at. One was for the Māori Health Authority to be more or less a crown entity of some kind of like Health New Zealand. Then on the other end of things, to set up a whole new kind of statutory entity that has Māori control in some form. The example they use is Te Matawai, which is one that I looked at about a year ago as one I thought was worth exploring. And then they've explored a middle ground, a hybrid, which has a separate statutory entity. It's not one of the normal Crown ones, but it has lots of the features of the normal Crown entities, including that the minister can appoint board members and decide when to remove them. So it takes that out of that third option. Māori would do that. In the middle option, the minister does it. So it keeps it much more in a kind of crown-controlled way. And they then, in the RIS, they go through and explain what are the trade-offs of each of this, and they land on that middle ground. But one of the reasons they land on the middle ground is that the Te Matawai example, that extreme end of Māori autonomy, gets a low rating for its ability to reflect partnership because the crown partner would be disadvantaged. I'm oversimplifying it, but it's kind of an interesting analysis that they land on a middle ground that I think has more control in the crown than what Māori have been talking about.
Are there other examples of independent statutory and give some idea of what might be in store?
Of the one that they went for or the ones that they...
Yeah, the one that they went for.
Now you are testing my recall. From memory, I don't think they spell one out. The one they use is Te Matawai, which is the more extreme version in their view. They actually probably do. I just can't recall.
Thanks for pointing that out, Gabrielle, that regulatory impact state be worth looking at.
They make some interesting things in their term about cost as well.
Mm-hmm, I see that now. Yes, the criteria they're using. Yeah, I think these are generic criteria Treasury may use.
When I looked at those three comparisons, one thing that did stand out to me in terms of language, because it was so unusual, the Standing Māori Advisory Group would not portend to partake the place of the treaty partner.
That is really interesting language, and I'm kind of glad you pointed that out because I did brush over it. But in the regulatory impact statement, they describe the treaty partnership sitting best with iwi and hapu at a local level, kind of at a locality level rather than at a minister central government level, although they don't mention that last bit. A number of iwi have looked for post-settlement arrangements to have some kind of partnership with the Ministry of Health and the minister, and that's almost, in my experience, almost always been pushed to being at a DHB level because that's what the system considers most appropriate.
So we've still got the functions of the Māori Health Authority. Along with Health NZ, one of their functions is to own and operate services, which is probably kind of new in terms of having another Crown entity that's owning and operating health services.
And when I see this list, my first thing I think is I'm wondering what things they would do from day one, what things are being put in there so that they can do them in the future versus what things will they be tooled up to do immediately? And that was one that I thought, I wonder if they'll be doing that straight away or if that's a later on in case of emergencies thing.
Yeah, because presumably the functions that have been transferred from the Ministry of Health early on would include the Māori Health Directorate going over to the Māori Health Authority, I assume, but I...
I'm highly clear, but so the Waitangi Tribunal released its follow-up final chapter and the week before, well, not even the week, like 2 days before the Pai Order Bill was tabled in Parliament. And one of the things it says is that the Māori Health Authority looks really promising, and the claimants who have pushed for this for decades seem to have gone further than they expected in a really short space of time. But they still maintain this concern that the devil's still in the details, that they still can't wrap their head around. And this was before the bill was tabled, but then I read the bill almost, immediately after. I'm like, I think there's still some devil in this detail here. Like, there's still stuff you need to know that you still can't quite put your finger on.
Another thing that popped out for me here was because I've read other documents and I'm never quite sure quite how strong this part is the monitor the delivery of whaora Māori services by Health NZ. So that's one of the roles of the Māori Health Authority, is actually a monitoring role of Health NZ. I know it's been talked in the past about a veto role as well, and it was quite hard going through this legislation to see where that veto might come up.
Oh, there is no role of veto.
No.
So in here, if Health New Zealand and the Māori Health Authority disagree, it gets escalated to the minister and the minister makes a call. So there's no right of veto.
No. Okay, so we've got anything more here in the functions of the Māori Health Authority?
Yeah, the one I circled was own and operate services, but I think that's a sort of a backstop option, isn't it? And monitor with TPK, with Te Puni Corcoran.
Yes.
There was the other one I was about to mention, just as noteworthy.
I mean, how does that compare to other things, Gabrielle?
The thing that's noteworthy to me about that is that Te Puni Corcoran have always had this responsibility to monitor the way that the Crown does Māori health. It's got that. And the Waitangi Tribunal was really, I think, quite cutting about how Te Puni Corcoran hadn't discharged that responsibility in the context of health. So they said that in 2019. So I know, well, rather, it's probably more that I suspect Te Puni Corcoran would have been thinking about what that means. And I'm wondering if this is kind of the result that they see. They want to do that role, but they need to do it with someone else. The other thing was that, and I heard Stephen say this as well, that he'd been drawing on the thinking of Te Puni Kōkiri around whānau water commissioning, so officials being part of the transition unit. So I don't know if it's necessarily a role going anywhere so much as learning from the role TPK has been playing.
Okay,
so we'll go down through engaging with and reporting to Māori.
This one was kind of interesting to me because there was always a responsibility to report, you know, to share information with Māori about how well DHBs were doing. Mm-hmm. So this kind of expands on it quite a bit. And the thing that struck me here is the way that they describe Māori organisation. And that it includes Māori health professional organisations. So that's the surprising one to me. So it includes iwi Māori partnership boards, iwi and hapū authorities, runanga trust boards, Māori health professional organisations, and representatives of whānau and hapū. So having a specific place for Māori health professionals, I mean, I'm not surprised that they have a role, but it's just interesting that that's where the line has been drawn, not somewhere else.
So again, we've got details about the makeup of the board, which is what we had with the Health NZ, similar knowledge, but obviously far more detailed with regard to experience of Māori, te ao Māori. Again, notes the cultural safety and responsiveness of services.
This clause, which is about how the minister appoints the board, is one of the things that comes up in the regulatory impact statement. So this is one of the ways that I think you can tell it's more on the Crown side than on Māori side, because the minister gets to determine. And it's quite good to me, though, that there's a list of the expertise, because in the district health board world, the minister has always had the role of appointing Māori members to district health boards. And that was a really mystical process. I wouldn't say that there was no rhyme or reason, but it wasn't a transparent rhyme nor reason about how people got onto those. And in the past, I've OAA'd the papers around appointments to try to get my head around it. And the stuff I'm most interested in is all redacted. So I welcome the transparency here.
The Hauora Māori Advisory Committee, presumably part of its role would be advising the minister on appointments.
It's hard for me to read and talk to you at the same time, but I'm pretty sure there's something in there about how the minister needs to pay heed to the...
It is actually, yes, except that the minister must consult the Hauora Māori Advisory Committee.
Consult is not, it's still a minister's decision, but yeah.
But there's a must there.
I'll grant you it's something, yes.
When we're looking at words, it's an imperative. Removal of members. I must have glanced over that in the Health NZ section.
No. Oh, I don't think there was an equivalent.
I hope no one who is a real proper lawyer is listening, because I will just sound completely wrong here. I'm pretty sure it will be connected to how it's a standard Crown entity.
It's
an existing structure, yep. Whereas the Māori Health Authority is a completely new structure.
So, yes, so if we go down to 25 Application of Crown Entities Act to the Māori Health Authority, then we do realise that it's not exactly being treated the same as an ordinary Crown entity, so that would explain. Okay, and then we get down to subpart 4, which is the disputes that we talked about earlier with regard to not having a veto, that any problems that arise between Health NZ and the Māori Health Authority get escalated to the minister. I think in the early days with the Cabinet paper, Andrew Little spoke about the need for also the Ministry of Health, good working relationships between all three of those entities. Presumably, if they were in dispute with the Ministry of Health, he would also be stepping in.
Is it worth reading this one?
Go ahead.
Yes, okay. Share the load. Clause 28, Section 28, disputes between Health New Zealand and Māori Health Authority. If Health New Zealand and the Māori Health Authority disagree on a matter that they were required under this Act to work together on, jointly develop or agree, A, either party may give written notice to the other party that they wish to resolve the dispute in accordance with this section, B, as soon as practicable, after a party has received written notice, the chief executives of each party must meet and use their best endeavours to resolve the dispute. Then, subclause 2, A, must refer to the dispute to the minister if they have not resolved it within 20 working days after the date a party received written notice under subsection 1A, or B, they may refer to the dispute to the minister earlier if they agree. And then 3 is the minister may determine the dispute or a process to resolve the dispute, and for that purpose may require any party to provide information to the minister. And 4, the parties must comply, this is the kicker really, must comply with the minister's determination or the process determined by the minister and its outcome.
So it could be pistols at dawn.
Only if it's 20 working days, right?
I can just imagine the minister sitting in his office and hearing the footfall, you know, footsteps coming down, two chief executives. That would be a bad day.
Well, one would wonder if the dispute has got to the point where it requires, you know, this part of the act to be activated, then I don't think they'll be waiting 20 days to go to the minister.
No. I'm glad you read that out. Chief executives of each party must meet and use their best endeavours to resolve the dispute.
But obviously, this may have a cooling effect in some way, Gabriella. As with a lot of these things, it's probably going to be very rare or unlikely that things will get to that point. But having this behind it, you know, means that each party knows how far they can push. And that's the point.
Okay, so we next subpart 5, key health documents, and we've gone over these already a bit before, the health strategy, Hauora Māori strategy, Pacific health strategy, disability health strategy, the health plan. There is a note, the Health NZ and the Māori Health Authority to approve locality plans. So we've come back to the issue around locality plans, which you mentioned earlier. The health charter to guide health entities and their workers, and the minister to determine a code of consumer participation to support consumer participation and enable the consumer voice to be heard. Right. There's a typo there, folks.
Just well done.
Anyone
enable the consumer to be voiced to heard.
There's a,
it could mean
the,
something.
The Crown Law Office.
Could have been written by an artificial intelligence bot.
I just take my hat off to people who go through and do the punctuation.
I know.
I don't know why I keep looking at GPS and thinking in the government spy agency. I know it's got nothing to do with them, but their GPS.
The GPS means geographic positioning system.
And yeah, I know. It's the government policy statement. It's not a good one to abbreviate. Is this new, by the way, the government policy statement on health? Yeah.
Yeah, very new. My question was, it's a 3-yearly thing. So when in the electoral cycle is it meant to be? Or plan hangs off it. The health plan hangs off it as well. So if we're moving more from a 1-year to a 3-year sort of logic in planning cycles, then the crucial question becomes, where does that sit in relation? Maybe someone has an answer to that. It doesn't have to be in the legislation.
Okay. One of the things I kind of welcome about this, even though I too had the time frame thing, how long it applies for is kind of a question mark, that the health system is really fragmented because of the roles and responsibilities that it all has. They have the roles of HQSC being this big, the role of the Ministry of Health being this big, whatever. So I quite like the idea of some kind of statement that tries to unify it, not breaking it down into a set of separate strategies. So I think there's potential.
Yeah, I mean, I think it expands on, you know, early in the term of a government, you know, once you get your feet in your slippers, you know, just tell us what your priorities are.
Interestingly, the minister may amend the GPS at any time, how that would affect the other strategies that have been drawn up to enact it. And then we've got the health strategy, the Hauora Māori strategy, Pacific health strategy, disability health strategy, all jobs of the minister, obviously the ministry.
Ministry. It's got something to do here.
Mm.
I find all of it interesting, obviously. There's this kind of, what are the current needs? What are the long-term, medium to long-term trends we need to think about? And what are the priorities we're going to set up for services? And which is, you know, sounds sensible to me. But it's, I also know that the iwi partnership boards are being encouraged to think about what their local health needs are. And so to me, there's going to be an interesting period of kind of trying to marry up these national level strategies with this push for what do your local whānau want? And here's our national strategy telling you this is the priority. What if it's not for your local population?
Yeah, and that was one of the points that was raised in the regulatory impact statement around this changing structures, around the tension between national consistency and local variation that is needed to meet local needs.
One thing on the New Zealand Health Strategy, a question from this is, you know, setting up something called New Zealand Health Strategy. We have one that was refreshed in 2016. Is this the same thing or is this slightly or somewhat different? And the thing that struck me here was contain an assessment of the medium and long-term trends and risks that will impact on health outcomes and health system performance in the next 5 to 10 years. I'm not sure whether that's trying to be anything more specific than that than was in 2001 or the 2016 health strategy, but it does seem to be a bit more, what's the word I'm looking for, less airy-fairy, more grounded or something? I don't know.
Again, how that fits in with the GPS, which is 3 years.
And this is more about the health outcomes and I guess the other parts of the health, how the health system or health services fit into that. But I guess the question there is, does this have any impact on other parts of government outside the health sector about what their contribution is to the New Zealand health strategy if it's about health outcomes?
I mean, I immediately think of housing when I see this. Mm. Housing is likely to be a very high priority for lots of people in a locality. For some localities, it will be the top health priority or very close to it. And how much will these strategies touch on those things?
Mm. Question, Barbara, just there. I mean, I'd be interested in a Pacific health strategy and whether there's something substantively different or new about that. I don't know, but I think that's an important question to ask.
The new thing about the Pacific strategy being that it's legislated. It wasn't in the Public Health and New Zealand Public Health and Disability Act. So I think that that's an improvement when it comes to visibility, and it helps that Pacific strategies, we've had two, not just be brushed to one side. They're now embedded as part of it.
And you've made a similar point about the naming of the Disability Health Strategy earlier on. Just going to scroll down now, we get to the New Zealand Health Plan. Key part of the reforms, it does appear to be, given that it's going to be prepared jointly by Health NZ and the Māori Health Authority, a costed plan for delivery of publicly funded health services, taking into account the functions of those other agencies. It's quite detailed about what the plan must include. I don't know if that's something that you would expect.
Yeah, key services and activities to be delivered. I mean, at what level of granularity would that be? One question I'd have. And key performance measures, how will this fit with, for instance, what Minister Little announced back in August at the GP conference about the health system improvement framework? Is this the same thing, or is this something different they're referring to there? Mm. I'm aware that the health system improvement framework doesn't have a heck of a lot of visibility even within the ministry. So there's lots of use of the word health system performance, which when I look at it in this draft legislation, I'm not sure what it's referring to. Is it a generic term, or is it referring to some specific policy?
Okay. So now we come to localities and locality plans. First point, number one, Health NZ must determine, with agreement of the Māori Health Authority, geographically defined areas, in brackets, localities, for the purpose of arranging services.
The next one's important. Health New Zealand must ensure that all of New Zealand is covered by a locality.
Yeah, and the boundary of locality is consistent with any regional arrangement specified in regulations made under Section 97.
Now, this is the first time that we come across any reference to something regional. So in the Cabinet paper, I think the idea that Health New Zealand would be divided into four regions was something that was flagged quite prominently, whereas I think here, maybe they're learning from the lessons of the 1990s that, yes, I mean, that might be their starting position, but it could change and it wouldn't matter. Mm. It might be, they're not sort of hardwiring regional boundaries into the legislation. I think that's quite important to note.
Did I see you scrolling down to Section 97 there, Gabrielle?
Yes, but it was just the regulations provisions.
Didn't help, did it? I tried that.
It was a little bit of a non-event.
Okay.
I agree.
So Health New Zealand may, with the agreement of the Māori Health Authority, amend the number of boundaries of any localities at any time, as long as the requirements in subsection 2 are met. I don't know what the requirements in subsection 2 are, but it is interesting that they can amend the boundaries at any time. Well, I know the localities are part of Health NZ, but I don't know. I kind of thought that maybe they were...
Well, this gets us to the $64 million question, which is who's running the localities or how are they to be run?
Yeah.
And to what extent is it Health New Zealand, sort of running the show here, or is this a function that's going to be picked up by what are currently PHOs or other organisations in the sector, which has been talked about? So how that relationship works, well, it's clearly to be worked out, but it's not specified here.
No. And one thing that was repeated in one of the regulatory impact statements consistently was localities involving networks of community and primary care providers, which that network word came up a lot.
So there's nothing about them here. And I'm presuming that, establish the localities. Well, actually, that's the other thing. It says the time frame of this. The localities may not be in place. This whole thing of localities takes effect 2 years after the passage of the legislation. So we could be still wondering what what the locality system is going to look like in 2024. And then they're required to do locality plans, and that's the next section, 49. And there's something there about the plans must take effect 3 years after the commencement date. I think commencement date is the commencement date of the Act. So we're legal novices here, but Me, I'll speak for myself. So we may not see what this looks like really for another 3 or 4 years.
So where do you get that timing from, Tim?
Down somewhere in the bowels of the bill somewhere.
One thing I'd like to say with regard to the Iwi Māori Partnership Boards is by the time I've read the other documents, the regulatory impact statements in the legislation, I felt very strongly the heavy weight that's been given to those boards as the treaty partner. And I think when the reforms were first announced, I suppose maybe like a lot of people, I thought the Māori Health Authority would be kind of in a slight partnership position. But now it's really clear that partnership boards are going to have that role and that they will be supported by the Māori Health Authority. But as you've already mentioned, there's a lot of work in that area. And even like you said about the locality services and making sure that localities meet the local needs. And
yeah, I think to me, the Iwi Māori Partnership Board's role is actually a really big one. And a lot of the philosophy behind the changes hinge on them being able to do a good job. Mm. I think it's a big ask and it requires really good support from day one, which is something you can't really legislate for. The legislation says it will be there.
Yeah.
But then how it happens day one.
And then that's sitting alongside localities, which, as we've mentioned before, are still kind of relatively ephemeral. Anyway, the New Zealand Health Charter, what would we like to say about that? Clause 50.
Yeah, this is for workforce and health entities government. Does it apply to non-government organisations that are delivering publicly funded services? No, it doesn't.
It was implied earlier on that it would do.
It was implied earlier on, but if you look at the definition of health entities, which we mentioned earlier, and that's who it applies to, that's Health New Zealand, Health Quality and Safety Commission, Māori Health Authority, PharmAct, and Blood and Organ Service.
It would be weird that it doesn't cover all the independent community and primary care providers.
It's certainly not as broad, at least in wording in the legislation, as the discourse around it before now.
Yeah. A health entity must have regard to the New Zealand Health Charter when planning for and contracting services. So presumably they could write it into the contract.
Write it into the contract, I guess, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, it's interesting. It's one of the few places that the word contract appears again.
It is interesting, isn't it? And like you said, we haven't seen anything about commissioning. I think we might have seen the word co-commission earlier on. Mm.
Commissioning is mentioned in the functions, but not in any great detail. And for the Māori Health Authority, its commissioning role is Kaupapa Māori Health Services and something around services for Māori, but it's quite loose. And as I've said before, that's not a defined term.
Yeah.
And it may be, I'm just speculating here, but it is trying to sort of future-proof the language in some way so that if commissioning became a dirty word for whatever reason, due to the practice of it, as, you know, contracting is for many people today, you know, it's you have a more plain language that can sort of survive that sort of trend, maybe reading too much into it.
Yeah. And next we've got the Code of Consumer Participation, which has also been kind of a key element from Andrew Little's point of view, of making sure the consumer is more involved in decisions around health services. And the Health Quality and Safety Commission must develop a code of consumer participation. I mean, the commission's already been doing a lot of work around surveying patients about services.
They've also been, at least within the system, the lead for consumer involvement in district health boards. So they've issued the guidance around that. I don't know if either of you have looked at that before, but I'll give you my 5 cents. Like, I hope that they do better than they did with their DHB work. HQSC did the DHB consumer guidance. I hope that this is a step change better than that work. It's interesting to me that they would be doing this.
It comes from, I guess, you know, literature about quality or research about quality, and then sort of consumer expectations sits under the definition of quality. In so many other sectors, that seems quite a bizarre route to, you know, sort of how public engagement or consumer engagement or whatever word we're using would feed into the system. So it's a very peculiar route.
There we've come down to Minister may appoint Crown observers. Obviously, that's if there are problems they're around the performance of Health NZ or the Māori Health Authority. And that then does go on to the issue of being able to dismiss the board or appoint a commissioner, which is kind of something we touched on earlier, that they hadn't mentioned that with regard to Health NZ. So that is spelt out.
Yeah, I'm not sure what to say about that. I mean, it would be the nuclear option, wouldn't it? Yeah, fine to do it for one DHB, leaving it in their back pocket to do it.
So, folks, we're quickly scrolling through now because we have a slight time constraint here, and we're zipping through PharmAct and the New Zealand Blood and Organ Service. and Health Quality and Safety Commission.
Which is, you know, I guess the same role as it had before.
Yes, presumably.
Presumably. It does say that in the notes at the beginning. That
so 48 pages.
If I was to pick one more thing to talk about, my final thing to talk about for time.
Yes.
It's the Hawarau Māori Advisory Committee.
Yes.
Here, on that page right now.
Oh, look at that. We're on the same page, literally. So this is the idea that the minister must establish a Hawarau Māori Advisory Committee to provide them advice on matters around the appointment of the Māori Health Authority Board, the Māori Health Authority Improvement Plan when it's required, expectations of the Māori Health Authority, directions to the Māori Health Authority, and amendments to the Māori Health Authority Statements of Intent. So this is to make it so it's not just the minister without some trusted advisors, but it is still that role of trusted advisors. It's not a decision-making body.
Okay, so I'm just zipping down. So we go on down through to the public health provisions, the new public health advisory committee. One thing I wanted to point out to our primary care providers is that what is currently Section 88 under the current Act is now Section 90 with regard to payments. And scrolling on through.
You mean because they have kept the same number?
I think while I'm scrolling for so time. Close. First New Zealand health plan must be take effect on a date no later than 2 years after the commencement date. So this is maybe where you found the details. Yeah, the locality plan takes effect 2 years after the commencement date. Yeah,
you can tell me where it is.
It's section subpart one, application of certain provisions of the Act.
92.
Schedule one.
Oh, right. Okay.
As time starts to run out for us, it does specify that every employee of a DHB becomes an employee of Health NZ on the same terms and conditions. However, a chief executive of a DHB does not become an employee of Health NZ under the schedule, but doesn't say what happens to them.
Nobody knows yet.
You mentioned earlier about how tightly this was written. It's actually about 60 pages shorter than the current legislation, the Public Health and Disability Services Act. I'm telling you that now because we won't have time for our system fix quiz. Okay, guys, so how did you find that in general, that kind of quick read through, speed read of a new piece of legislation?
Surprisingly fun.
What interested me was that we often picked up on the same things. I wasn't necessarily expecting that.
No, I wasn't expecting that either. And I had them marked and read and I'm thinking to myself, oh, is that actually interesting or not? But in fact, you validated a lot of the things I marked up, which actually kind of just comes back to real basics, as Gabrielle said, it was more fun than we expected, which just goes to show that we are, in fact, health reform junkies. Nga mihi nui. Thank you, guys. And we'll catch you again real soon because there's lots happening now.
It's going to be fast-paced now till the end of the bill, at least.
Okay, so we didn't quite make it all the way through the bill, but I like to think we got through the guts of it. A few of the items you will find in the last two-thirds of the bill include provisions applying to Pharmac, the New Zealand Blood and Organ Service, and the Health Quality and Safety Commission. Ministerial committees are detailed, including the Hawarau Māori Advisory Committee, which Gabrielle did cover off, and there's the National Advisory Committee on Health Service Ethics and the new Expert Advisory Committee on Public Health. Crown funding arrangements, powers in relation to service commissioning, more on Section 90, once with Section 88, are also detailed. The Director General of Health gets a mention with the power to request from a health entity information in relation to any matter. And there is provision made for entitlement cards, something that needs closer inspection. Employment arrangements for DHB staff moving to Health NZ are also outlined. It will be interesting to see what sort of leave liability the new agency has on day one. And then a good 30 pages are devoted to changes to acts, legislative instruments, and revoking of orders. Then there's a list of current iwi Māori partnership boards, details on mortality review committees. We suspected there were some changes to the status quo here, but we weren't quite sure what they might be. The legislation winds up with provisions relating to imposition and payment of ministry levies. Essentially, the last four pages are all about alcohol. Reading this legislation literally drives you to drink. Pretty much as soon as we recorded this podcast, the government made its announcement on the future of disability support services, moving responsibility to a new ministry for disabled people, a change many from the disability sector had been calling for. Copies of the regulatory impact statements that we mentioned in the podcast are available on the Health and Disability Review Transition Unit page of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet website. Go to the publications link and click on Regulatory Impact Statement, Decision on the Organisational Form of a Māori Health Authority, and you will find the four documents covering the reform changes on that page. If you subscribe to New Zealand Dr. Rata Aotearoa, you will find these documents and more at your fingertips. Happy reading. Thanks again for listening to System Fix. If you have any queries or issues you would like to hear discussed, please contact me on editor@nzdoctor.co.nz. Thanks for listening to System Fix, brought to you by the Health Media. If you would like to learn more about the health reforms and other issues in primary care, you can subscribe to New Zealand Doctor, Rata Aotearoa, on nzdoctor.co.nz. Or to keep up with issues in the pharmacy sector, go to pharmacytoday.co.nz. Both publications now offer monthly subscriptions. Thank you to Steve Hart for post-production work on System Fix. This is Barbara signing off. Until next time. Thanks for listening. Nga mihi nui.